AM950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. You're on FYI Politics with Brett Johnson. It is the Thursday edition of the show. Lots of news to get to today as we're going to be talking about what's happening in CD5. Then later on, we're going to be speaking with Santita Jackson, who is going to be debuting her new morning show on AM950 starting next weekend, airing weekdays from 6 until 8 a.m. One other quick programming note, Matt McNeil is out today, so Gregory Rich of Drink in the Style is going to be filling in for Matt coming up today at 3 o'clock along with Dan Newkirk. I'll be sitting in on that show as we'll do our best to wax poetic about all of the major political issues while trying to avoid the many, many FCC fines that could possibly come our way when we put Gregory Rich live on the airwaves. But don't miss that coming up today at 3. But first, let's talk more about what's happening in the 5th Congressional District, since that primary election is coming up on Tuesday. The race between the incumbent Ilhan Omar and her major challenger, Antone Melton Mukes. And joining us to break down this race is Hamline University political science professor David Schultz. Hey, David, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great, and thanks for all the listeners for tuning in.
Yeah, absolutely. So when you and I talked a few weeks ago, we were going through this race between Omar and Melton Mukes, and we were kind of thinking that, well, Omar is probably a slight favorite, but this thing might be a whole lot closer than people could give it credit for. What are you thinking about this race right now?
I actually think it's very close, and I'm going to give two examples of where I think it's close. One of them is when the DFL announced, I think it was it yesterday, filing suit against Melton Mukes, claiming efforts to avoid disclosure under federal campaign finance laws. And I mention that because the suit's probably going to go nowhere whatsoever, but it reflects the fact that I think that the Democrats are very worried that one of their endorsed candidates may be losing. It's usually the kind of move you do when you're worried about losing. And also, given the fact that Ilhan Omar and the Democratic Party establishment has tried to put the focus of the campaign onto Melton Mukes fundraising. So I think that's one big issue that's kind of looming out there. The other issue, or the other point, and I can't prove this, someone told me this, and it was interesting, is that as the Ilhan Omar campaign is doing their phone calling to get out the vote calls, so I had two people tell me that they got calls personally from Representative Omar, which I think is, if it's true, that's really unusual, because usually candidates are not spending time dialing on the phone, talking and asking for votes. And if they do, that really is a sign that they're very, very worried. So those are the two that I would point to. And there's a lot of others we can talk about, too. And I think we need to do it in terms of our analysis. But I think this is fascinating because it's a very close race, it looks like, at least not from the outside. It is turning into be perhaps the most expensive congressional race or primary this year, and it's got to be one of the most high-profile ones in the country right now.
Yeah, I can't remember a primary race in what, when you talk about the general election, is a relatively safe seat. I shouldn't even say relatively. It is a safe seat. It's going to go Democrat no matter what this fall. But in a primary election, I can't remember this much money being spent on a safe seat.
You're absolutely right. And to see this intensity of money within the same party. Now, I could see if you've got a general election, two parties slugging it out. I could see if we had a viable Republican primary also, but we're talking about what? Just a Democratic primary. And I know there's more than two candidates, but effectively we're looking at two candidates in this race who have raised about what? $3.1 million for one candidate, what, 2.6 for another. And if you throw in the estimates of third party money, we're hearing numbers of between $10 and $15 million in this race. And that is just astronomical, not just for Minnesota and Minneapolis, but nationwide. You don't see this kind of money thrown into a House primary race practically ever.
What I find interesting, too, is that Ilhan Omar, a few weeks ago, her campaign released a poll showing that she was up big, which obviously you can take internal polls, certainly with a grain of salt, but typically you don't see campaigns release internal polls in a primary race if they're way ahead. This is some really unusual behavior we're seeing from her campaign, and also going on a big media blitz, too.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, you're right. The poll, I don't put much stock in. And generally, you don't want to release polls that show you that you have big leads, because it leads to what? Complacency on the part of your supporters who think, gosh, Representative Omar is going to win big on August 11th. I don't need to really turn out the vote. So you would want to hide that existence, hide that, unless for some reason she thought by claiming she had such a big lead, she thought that would deflect some of the momentum from her challenger. That's a possibility. I don't know, but it's a very unorthodox strategy to try to approach in terms of doing that. But in terms of where the polling is right now, of course, nobody really knows, because nobody's polling. And what makes this, again, also a fascinating race is that if you put money into a television ad for the 5th District, you're probably on one of the major, television stations. And those stations are going to reach far more people than simply within the 5th District. So let's say, for example, we were talking about, let's say, a CBS affiliate, and you put money into that station for an ad. It's going to reach way more than the 700,000 people who are in CD5. So in one sense, you're really kind of wasting a lot of money. But that's what shows you what's so interesting about this race. And maybe it's inevitable, given the fact that the candidates can't get out and door knock or campaign, that they're being forced to have to put this money into television. But again, it still speaks to how competitive and high stakes this campaign appears to be.
So just today, the Star Tribune came out and their editorial board endorsed Antone Melton Mewkes, which, if you talk to the progressive left on Twitter, they absolutely skewered the Star Tribune for whatever that's worth. But when you look at newspaper endorsements nowadays, do they even still mean very much? Does this endorsement from the Strib really do much for Melton Mewkes and his campaign?
I'm not sure how much it does. Again, in the old days when people got primarily their news from newspapers, I think it probably had an impact. It's less now, of course, because of the declining newspaper viewership or readership, even online. But where it might be valuable is in a couple of ways, this endorsement nonetheless, is that this might help some of the, let's say, undecided swing voters, especially, I'm going to say, in the 5th District suburbs, who may not have been paying as much attention about the race. Maybe they like, maybe they're indifferent, I'll say, to Ilhan Omar, and they see an endorsement. So it might be worth a little bit there in terms of it. And just in general, it might just be valuable in terms of reminding voters, guess what? August 11th, there's an election, folks. Don't forget about it. So again, it'll have some value, but in terms of, is somebody going to say, oh my gosh, I was going to vote for Ilhan Omar, but now I've seen the light according to the Star Tribune, and I'm going to change my mind and vote the other way? There may be a couple of votes like that, but certainly the evidence doesn't support that kind of widespread defection.
So let's talk a little bit about the 5th Congressional District and what it makes up, because often we just think of it as just being Minneapolis, and that's not the case whatsoever. There are a lot of first and second ring suburbs that are part of CD5, and potentially that could be an area where Antone Melton Mewkes could do really well. What do you make about the breakdown of CD5 and how the votes could go between Omar and Melton Mewkes?
Okay, so according to the 2018 census, approximately, I think it's 60%, it's like 59.8% of the 5th District is the city of Minneapolis, and then you have a little bit of a dine-in that's in there, St. Louis Park, Golden Valley, and I can't remember if there's maybe another couple of other suburbs in there. But the point being, it's about 40% suburban, the district. Now, 4 years ago, when Ilhan Omar ran in the Democratic primary, she faced five other challengers, and who came in second was Margaret Anderson Kelleher. People might remember her name. She used to be Speaker of the House. She's now Commissioner of Transportation in Minnesota. Margaret Anderson Kelleher won big in the suburbs. The suburbs are more moderate compared to the city of Minneapolis voters. And I mention this because she lost, that is, Representative Omar did lose the suburbs 2 years ago. I would be surprised, absolutely stunned, unless you have a good reason to change my mind, that she's going to do better in the suburbs this time than she did 2 years ago. And especially in suburbs like St. Louis Park and Golden Valley, which have powerful, very active Jewish populations who are very upset with her. So I'm expecting Ilhan Omar not to do well in the suburbs. Melton Mew is going to do probably very well there. And then the question becomes one of how well does Ilhan Omar hold on to Minneapolis versus to what extent can Melton Mew divide some of her support within that within Minneapolis. And that's going to be critical because also I'm going to say that I think in, let's say, the Lake of the Isles area, right, South Minneapolis, Southwest Minneapolis, Ilhan Omar's probably not going to do well. She's going to have a highly motivated but relatively narrow base of support in Minneapolis, and the potential is there for her to lose suburbs, some of the more affluent parts of Minneapolis, and lose the primary.
Yeah, that's interesting to talk about kind of that Chain of Lakes area and especially Southwest Minneapolis. When I bike in that area all the time, I see a ton of signs for Adtown, not much for Ilhan Omar. So really, is this going to come down to a big turnout operation for her in areas like North Minneapolis, Northeast, or even if we're talking about kind of like the Seward neighborhood area? That's where she's really got to have a big turnout kind of campaign, correct?
I think so. And one of the things that many of us miss is 2 years ago when she won the primary and 4 years ago when she defeated Phyllis Kahn to win a state representative seat, what Ilhan Omar has been exceedingly very good at is using the social media and sort of digital platforms to motivate, recruit, and get out the vote among her supporters. And I'd be curious if you've heard anything on this one, but I have heard that she's doing a very good job on that again, and therefore that's why we're not seeing the lawn signs, which appeal to a different demographic. So that's what makes it interesting here. We basically have two different candidates appealing to, I would say, two different demographics within the Democratic Party, perhaps using different strategies, campaign strategies, to motivate their base. Now, Melton Mews is a little bit more traditional, a little bit more, are a little bit easier to see in terms of the lawn signs at all. But I suspect her campaign is still very active in the social media digital world.
Do you think there are any areas in CD5 that could kind of be swing areas that would give us an indication of how the election would go? Granted, we're looking at this at a very micro level, but I'm kind of comparing it to like the presidential election, where there's a few counties in like Michigan or Pennsylvania, where if they go for Biden or if they go for Trump, that gives us a pretty good indication on how the night is going to go. Do you think we have any of those sorts of areas in Minneapolis that would give us a hint as those early results come in as to how this race might turn out?
Yes, I do. Now, you're going to help me with sort of the neighborhoods in terms of describing them, for example, but I think look at neighborhoods perhaps like Longfellow, for example, I think wouldn't be a bad one to look at. Or I'm thinking of the area, and again, right, if you go from St. Paul, I live in St. Paul.
So yeah, I was going to say, you're a St. Paul guy here trying to talk about Minneapolis.
No, I'm trying to do this. But I was going to say, if you go from Highland Park across the Ford Bridge, you're around like 46th Street, you know, in Minneapolis, and the neighborhoods going up in that area. I think that might give us some sense in terms of it. And also I'd want to look at in North Minneapolis, to what extent is the vote divided there? Because I think that's, I think one of the things that's also interesting in this race is that a lot of people who are analyzing this race are throwing all people of color into one bucket. And that's a huge mistake, because what we should be thinking about here is that there's a difference between the African population in Minneapolis in the 5th District, that is people who have emigrated from Africa to the United States, versus the African-American population. And in many cases, their political interests align, but in some cases, they are different. And then even among those who have emigrated from Africa to the United States, they're not all from the same same country. And so to what extent is Ilhan Omar able to hold, let us say, the African vote and still hold on to some of the African-American vote, versus to what extent Melton Mew capture more of the African-American vote. So those would be things I would be looking at in terms of pictures. And, of course, we'd want to see how heavy the turnout actually is in the Cedar Riverside neighborhood. But I would say, you know, looking at more like Longfellow and so forth, kind of like, you know, middle class, you know, neighborhoods might give us some pictures as to where and I'm going to be blunt here, where some of the white Caucasian voters in Minneapolis are.
Yeah, absolutely. And even going back and talking about some of the black voters in the area, you brought up a good point that they often get lumped into one category, which isn't the case. I mean, we can even look at how Antone even got an endorsement from Nakima Levy Armstrong. I was blanking on that for a second.
Yeah.
Who, of course, is a very powerful voice in that area, which, yeah, could possibly splinter the vote that a lot of people are just assuming Ilhan Omar is automatically going to get.
Yeah, and I think that's been one of the things that's worked to Melton Mew's advantage, is that I think Representative Omar, up until about, I'm going to say, what, maybe 3 months ago, was in a pretty good position. You know, she didn't look like there was a viable challenger to her, and she didn't really have to work very hard in that district. And I think that's one of the things that she's now playing catch up on, is that her infrastructure in terms of get out the vote, in terms of reaching, you know, to broaden her base, I think she was caught a little bit by surprise by that. I mean, remember, 4 years ago when she won in the primary against Phyllis Kahn, it was a three-way primary opposition split. 2 years ago, it was a six-way race. Her six opponents split. So she has benefited tremendously from a divided opposition in ways that are not quite as divided this time. So she's got a base. No question about it, highly motivated, but to what extent has she broadened that base, and to what extent is she in a position to capture this broader vote? I don't know about you, if I can sort of shift the question a little bit here. I mean, one of the stories to me that's absolutely fascinating is, again, if you and I were talking, let's say, 4 months ago, 5 months ago, we would have said, gosh, Ilhan Omar, she's got free sledding to November. There's no viable challengers out there. There was rumors of lots of people like Andrea Jenkins and so forth, but nothing happened. And suddenly, pow, Melton Mew emerges, and he raises a phenomenal amount of money. This is a fascinating story when you think about it.
And what will be interesting, too, is that, let's say he pulls off what would be one of the biggest upsets in Minnesota political history, and he ends up winning the nomination. There's certainly going to be a major fracture within the Democratic Party, being that we already had that DFL lawsuit that was filed against his campaign. And then, to be honest, there are a lot of Republicans who are donating to his campaign and his super PAC. So if he ends up winning that nomination, it's going to be a very, very ugly situation for the Democratic Party in Minnesota.
The dangerous thing about filing that lawsuit yesterday, or that challenge, is that if he does win, It's going to create an incredibly, like you said, bad and ugly situation going forward in terms of mending things. So I think that was a dangerous move. Now, the other thing out here, and again, we're obviously all speculating. By the time we have a conversation like this next week, we may have an answer to who has won. But let us say, for example, Representative Omar were to lose. She's relatively young, a rising star. This is a pretty rapid closing of a door, and I wonder, what does she do now going forward? I mean, does she bide her time for 2 years and run for reelection? Does she move on and do something else? I mean, these become really interesting questions to also think about in terms of her political career, because, you know, she was one of the, I'll use Donald Trump's phrase, she was part of what? The squad, you know, the four progressive Democrats who in many ways were challenging him, challenging the Democratic Party hierarchy and establishment. And if she were to lose, that's a pretty big blow, I think, to not just her career, but let us say the left side of the Democratic Party.
Just a couple more minutes here left in the conversation. This is really interesting to analyze what's happening in CD5. But if she does go down, you brought up the fact that, yeah, she's relatively new to politics and is still very young. But all of a sudden, yeah, a door would definitely be kind of slammed on her career, at least temporarily. Is there any chance that she would possibly run as a third party? And perhaps the better question is, would there be any path if she were to run, let's say, as an independent, or maybe try to get the Green Party nomination if she were to lose the DFL primary but still try to seek that seat in the general election?
Well, it would be difficult for her to run as a let's say, a truly independent candidate at this point, simply because our campaign laws in the state, would make it difficult to sort of for her to qualify for the ballot at this late date. So I don't think that's an option. I don't know if at this point, if the Greens are even running somebody in that district, if they have an endorsed candidate. If not, there might still be a chance to go in that direction there. But I would say that if she were to lose, you know, this primary, her options for this November are pretty thin, because she would not be the endorsed party candidate at that point. And with the DFL so strong, having that endorsed DFL label next to your name, that's a pretty powerful badge to be wearing.
And final question here for you, David. Let's say Ilhan Omar does end up surviving this primary challenge. Do you think in future years this might kind of be a warning to other candidates, being that, well, we already tried a well-funded campaign primary against Ilhan Omar. It didn't succeed, so therefore we're not going to pour much money into this race again. Do you think if she survives that we're likely to not have any more really serious challengers to her in the future?
I think if she survives this one, she's in pretty good shape for a while. We generally know that the most vulnerable point for an incumbent is the first election when you're running for re-election. She survives this one, she's in probably pretty good shape, and the question becomes, where does she want to go from there? Does she want to stay in the House? Would she want to consider maybe perhaps running for Amy Klobuchar's seat down the line? Really, it's going to be a question of where she wants to go. But the other way I was going to phrase it also is, does she walk away if she wins? Does she walk away learning anything from this? Because I think some of the money that's going in against her, they want to beat her, but I think they also want to scare her. They want to scare her to say that you're going to come back a little bit more towards the center, or you're going to take less critical positions of Israel. I'll be curious to see what's the message that she takes away from this, no matter what, also.
Yeah, we'll have to see how things turn out next Tuesday, and hopefully have another interview next week and figure out what exactly happened in this race and some other interesting primaries. I know the Republicans have one that I think is worth following up in CD7 to see who is going to be challenging Colin Peterson this fall. So hopefully we can get into that next week. Hey, we've been speaking with Professor... Yeah, we've been speaking with Professor David Schultz, political science professor over at Hamline University. Also, make sure you follow his blog. That is schultzstake.blogspot.com. David, it'll be interesting next week to see what type of political world we're living in.
It will be, and hopefully we'll talk next week.
All right, sounds good. We'll take a break and come on back with more here on FYI Politics.
get $50 for your trade-in regardless of condition when you buy your new appliances from Warner Stellion. Buy at Warner Stellion and you get our already low price guarantee. Trusted free delivery, professional installation, and 18 months no interest financing. Choose from thousands of in-stock appliances with friendly specialists who save you time and money. Say goodbye to your tired appliances and get $50 rebates for a limited time from the specialists at Warner Stellion.
Even though these are challenging times, All Energy Solar is still committed to providing you a cost-effective, environmentally friendly energy system through their zero-contact protocol. Solar remains a great value and long-term investment, but some of the incentive programs will be expiring soon. All Energy Solar can walk you through the entire process. They can evaluate your property by phone or webinar, and can even complete preliminary design work without visiting your home. So start saving on your energy bill today and visit allenergysolar.com.
Food Freedom Radio is generously supported by Seward Co-op, now offering online ordering and pickup at both the Franklin and Friendship stores. Shop online at seward.coop/curbside and then pay over the phone. Just call when you arrive at the store for pickup. It's that easy and safe. Offering dedicated pickup times for our first responders, seniors, and those with compromised immune systems from 1 to 2 p.m. Start your shopping at seward.coop/curbside. Stay safe.
The Electric Fetus is now open Tuesday through Saturday from 10 to 6. There are limits to the number of people allowed in the store and masks are required. Web and phone orders are available for curbside pickup, but the Electric Fetus is currently only buying used vinyl and DVDs by appointment only at this time. Visit electricfetus.com for the latest info and to shop for music, gift department merchandise, and gift cards. 2000 4th Avenue South, Minneapolis, and electricfetus.com.
Hello, humans! This is me, Ellie Krug, with Ellie 2.0 Radio. I've got some exciting news. I'm moving! No, not physically, but my show, Ellie 2.0 Radio, is moving from Monday mornings to Monday afternoons. Beginning on August 10th, you'll be able to hear Ellie 2.0 Radio on Monday afternoons from 2 to 3. It will still be the same show you've come to love, where I talk about idealism and changing the world. So please, tune in for Ellie 2.0 Radio every Monday afternoon from 2 to 3. See you then!
I'm Paula Overby, candidate for U.S. Senate. Americans want a nation we can feel proud of, but today, Americans are facing 40 million evictions while Congress votes to spend our tax dollars on needless wars. This is what a nation run by billionaires and party insiders has wrought upon America. With your support, we can take back our democracy and once again be proud of our nation. Donate today at paulaoverby.com. I'm Paula Overby. I endorse this message, and I thank you for your support.
Paid for by the Paula Overby for Congress Committee.
Hi, everybody. I'm Santita Jackson, and I want you and all your friends to join my new show, The Santita Jackson Show, weekdays on AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. We've got the best in progressive talk, political and personal, and we will have the most stirring conversations with the most exciting voices from the fields of politics, health, culture, business, and religion.
That's The Santita Jackson Show, coming to the AM 950 airwaves beginning next week and airing weekdays live from 6 until 8 a.m.
During this stay-at-home time, many of us are getting around to what needs doing at home. So how is your vacuum cleaner running? Is it time to get it repaired or maybe even replaced? Great news! A1 Vacuum in Roseville is open for curbside service. We're here from 10 until 2, Monday through Saturday. Give us a call at 651-222-6316 to place your order for curbside supplies, repairs, or replacements. Find more information and updates at a-1vacuum.com.
With your AM 950 weather, I'm Brett Johnson. Look for partly sunny skies today with a high near 80. Tonight, cloudy with a low around 66. Friday, a slight chance for rain with a high near 83. And Saturday, cloudy with a high around 87.
Don't miss the Longevity Expo this Saturday only at the Maple Grove Community Center. See up to 150 exhibitors. Find all the resources to help you live a longer, healthier, and more active lifestyle. This Saturday only at the Maple Grove Community Center. See it all at expoguys.com. That's expoguys.com.
AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. You're on FYI Politics with Brett Johnson. As a heads up, I am running solo today without a producer, so if you call me during the break, I will be able to get you on the airwaves. Also coming up, we're going to be speaking with Santita Jackson in the next segment, as she is going to be our new weekday morning host, as she'll be hosting a weekday show from 6 until 8 p.m. beginning this coming Monday. She has a really good background to hear about. She is the daughter of the Reverend Jesse Jackson. She's been hosting a syndicated talk show for a while, so get to learn about her in just a few minutes. But let's head to the phone lines and talk to Harvey in Minneapolis. Hey there, Harvey. What are you thinking about today?
Well, Brett, you interviewed Melton Mew for, he kept saying primary care for all, and to this day, I don't know what that is, what it covers. Do you know? I tried to look it up on the internet, and all I could find was an article in the Journal of the American Medical Association, and to get that, I had to subscribe to it. So yeah. What is it?
So what my best guess would be, and I tried asking him a little bit about this too, is that I think he's talking about like visiting your family doctor or when you're going to have like your routine checkup, or let's say you have strep throat or strep throat symptoms, you would typically go to the doctor and get that test. I think that's what he's talking about. I don't think that necessarily includes like emergency room visits, but this is me kind of freestyling on this. I'm kind of in the same boat as you in terms of what that means. But from what I've read is that he's mostly kind of on board with the expansion of Obamacare and then having a public option, which is a very similar position as to what Joe Biden currently has, or Ilhan Omar's more on the side of Medicare for all with Bernie Sanders and AOC. So that's kind of what I'm reading into the situation with the stance on health care.
Okay, that helps a lot. And then just as an aside, I looked up, my mailbox is full of stuff from Americans for Tomorrow's Future endorsing him damn near every day. Mm-hmm. And Americans for Tomorrow's Future treasurer is a big Republican whose law firm represents Moscow Mitch, the U.S. Senatorial Republican Committee, the U.S. House Campaign Committee, etc. I suspect the Israeli lobby is funneling money through Americans for Tomorrow's Future. What do you think?
I think there's no doubt that we are seeing a lot of dark money put into that race, and I think you're very accurately stating that there are members of the Israeli lobby that would like to see Ilhan Omar defeated. Now, whether they like Anton Melton Mewkes, I think, is another question. I think their position is more, we just got to get Ilhan Omar out of there. So, yeah, you're probably seeing, I don't live in CD5, so I haven't quite been exposed to the amount of mailings that you've probably been getting. But, yeah, there is a lot of dark money being raised in that district and being sent out with mailers and television commercials. And oftentimes they try to really disguise these things, too, where it could be coming from a Republican PAC like you're talking about. And they position it as being, oh, yeah, we're just some progressive fundraising group, even though that's not the case whatsoever. So I'm glad you at least did a little research and figured out that, oh, yeah, this group that's doing mailers, they're just a Republican front group.
Thanks for your help, Brett. You're doing a heck of a job.
All right. Thanks for the call there, Harvey. I do appreciate it. Just a few more minutes before we got ahead to that interview with Santita Jackson. I don't know why I said we got ahead to that interview, as if it's some sort of obligation. No, you'll actually like hearing about the background of Santita Jackson. I had a chance to listen to her show this morning. It currently airs on WCPT Chicago, and you're really going to love the guests she has on her show. In fact, today she interviewed her niece, who goes to a private school in Chicago, and was talking about how she's been exposed to a ton of racism from some of her white classmates. So that'll be Santita Jackson. I'll be speaking with her in just a couple of minutes. Before we get to that, though, I do want to touch on one other big news story, and that is what happened with the Minneapolis Charter Commission last night, because they were going to make a recommendation or not make a recommendation as to whether this ballot measure is going to be included in the November election, as to whether the Minneapolis Police Department will be abolished or defunded. Well, what happened? The Charter Commission ended up punting on the issue, or filibustering. They said they wanted to spend another 3 months studying this proposal from the Minneapolis City Council that would, I don't know if I would necessarily say abolish the police department, but definitely significantly reform it. So they'll be taking an extra 3 months to study the issue. Now, the reason why that's significant is that with the three-month delay, that means the question will not be put before Minneapolis voters in time for the November election. And this is something that has happened in the past with the Charter Commission, as it was 2018 when the City Council also put through another police reform proposal. And in that case, the Charter Commission, again, punted on the issue, didn't make a ruling, but at least filibustered to the point where it was not able to make it on the 2018 ballot. And one final thing to bring up about the Charter Commission, it's kind of a mysterious group. There are 15 members that are appointed by a judge, and they don't exactly represent or make up the city's population very well. Minnesota Daily, of course, the newspaper of the University of Minnesota, published some information about the members of the Minneapolis Charter Commission. Of the 15 members, 12 of them are white. They only have 3 non-white members, which is unbelievable when you consider that in the city of Minneapolis, about half the population is made up of people of color. I'm not saying you need exact representation, but really just having 3 of the 15 members be people of color, not exactly a good look. And then how about this? This is possibly even more egregious. Of the 15 members, guess how many are from North Minneapolis? 0. None. No one is from North Minneapolis on that commission. In fact, how many members are from Northeast Minneapolis? 1. Almost all of these members come from either downtown Minneapolis or Southwest Minneapolis. And looking at the backgrounds of some of the people on this commission, one is a former tobacco lobbyist. Another is the treasurer of a pro-business PAC, which a couple elections ago spent about $250,000 of business interest money in the last city election, while another member of this charter commission used to be the chair of the Republican Party of Hennepin County. Yeah, it's not exactly representing Minneapolis very well, the members of this charter commission. In fact, several of the members have served on the commission for upwards of 15 years. So there definitely needs to be some reform in terms of who is even on this commission in the first place. I'm not saying you need direct representation, but I mean, come on. Only 3 of the 15 members are people of color. Most of them are well-connected lobbyists, and they almost all live in either downtown Minneapolis or Southwest Minneapolis. Yeah, they definitely need to make some changes on the Charter Commission, and I'm not even sure how you go about doing that, being that they aren't elected officials. They're appointed by a judge, so that'll be a question for another day as to how you make some changes with who makes up that Minneapolis Charter Commission. All right, we'll take a break and come on back and be speaking with Santita Jackson, who again is going to be hosting our new weekday morning show from 6 until 8 a.m. beginning on Monday. It's on the way next here on FYI Politics.
Nightingale at 26th and Lindale is open for in-person service. They have a lovely socially distanced patio and interior available for safe and thoughtful dining and drinks. Nightingale has reservations via resi.com with plenty of tables and bar spots saved for walk-up reservations. Nightingale's temporary summer hours are Sunday through Thursday from 4 to 10 p.m., Friday and Saturday 4 p.m. to midnight. Last call for full menu 30 minutes before close with curbside takeout by calling 612-354-7060. Info, menu, and updates at nightingalempls.com.
Hi, I'm Scott Peterson with the Minnesota News Network, inviting you to join us this week for Minnesota Matters, a news, entertainment, and sports show covering everything that matters in the North Star State. Tune us in right here or at your convenience at MinnesotaNewsNetwork.com.
Listen to Minnesota Matters every weekend, Saturday mornings at 5:30 and Sunday mornings at 6:30 on AM 950.
AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. You're back on FYI Politics with Brett Johnson. Yeah, I just find this conversation about TikTok and what's happening with this company so interesting. So let's get back to it. We are speaking with Adam Raziere. He is the chief marketing officer with Agency Partner Interactive. He is a social media expert. Let's get to part two of the conversation where we're going to be talking more about Microsoft's potential purchase of TikTok. Here it is. So as I mentioned a few minutes ago, the Trump administration does seem to somewhat be walking back the idea of banning TikTok. And a big part of that has to do with the fact that Microsoft is interested in purchasing the U.S. operations of TikTok. So, Adam, as we were just talking about, we have all of these hearings that are taking place in social media companies that are facing all sorts of scrutiny. Now, Microsoft wants to get in the game and buy TikTok for, as what I'm reading here, as much as like $30 billion. Why exactly do they want to do this? It's going to, of course, cost them a heavy price, and then they're likely going to face the same sort of scrutiny that we've seen other social media companies face.
Oh, yeah. You know, Microsoft, they've been trying to kind of be a more of a dominant player in the social media scene for quite some time. If you look back in time, you know, look back to 2007, Facebook was just a three-year-old company. And back at the time, Microsoft invested something like $240 million to get about a 1.3 or 1.6% interest in the business. They earned about $1 billion from that investment. So Microsoft knows there's a lot of value in social media. But the problem is as a company, they've failed so many times when it comes to launching their own social platform. There was a social networking platform called Social that launched in 2012, and that ultimately closed in 2017. It just wasn't really accepted by the market. So, you know, when a company comes in and they see basically another player who's doing things and doing things successfully, it's a much safer sort of move for them to go and try to acquire an already successful business than to literally start one from scratch. Now, you know, Microsoft as a business, I think from a consumer perspective, TikTok would be a huge advantage to them because they could use all of that information to basically channel that data into their R&D system and then generate really cool, innovative and new software and hardware for the market. Stuff that uses augmented reality, stuff that the market, based on the data that they're collecting in TikTok, is most likely to accept. You know, they've done the business thing pretty well, the B2B side of things with LinkedIn. So I think TikTok really just kind of opens up a better door for them to connect with Gen Z and just a lot of consumers that are about to hit the market with frankly, a lot of spending power.
And would the data that would be collected by the app be any more protected under Microsoft? As I'm looking at it here, Microsoft would still be collecting the same sort of data that the app is already doing. It would just be going to Microsoft instead of potentially the Chinese government. Is that kind of the only difference we would see?
For the most part, yeah. You know, I think there's a better layer of accountability there. You know, the thing that's going to make this deal tricky, though, you know, Microsoft's not trying to buy all of TikTok. They're just trying to buy really the U.S. assets of TikTok, also Canada, Australia, and New Zealand. So the deal itself has to get done first, right? And frankly, that's going to be a challenging deal to put together. Like you said, it's going to cost a fair sum of money. You know, check the cushions of the couch and see if you got it, right? But the end result for the average consumer, if Microsoft ends up buying TikTok, just a little bit more certainty about where the data is being stored physically here in the United States. You know that there are going to be a lot of strong efforts behind protecting that user data. You also know that there's accountability. So if there is, you know, a terrible leak of some sort, or if the data is, you know, used for unscrupulous purposes, we can at least hold somebody accountable. The threat, though, is always going to be there. Whether Microsoft owns it or whether you own it, the Chinese can still go after it, right? They have a really, really big hacking operation. And Brett, I'll be serious. So I actually went through the process of creating a TikTok business account. I didn't fully verify the account, but I got halfway through it, right? Mm-hmm. Within that same week, I have three Google business profiles. Each profile started getting attacked by Chinese IP addresses, basically attempts to try and ultimately gain ownership of my business profiles. You know, I've been in business since 2010. This has never happened, but it did happen the week that I tried to onboard TikTok business.
Well, that raises certainly some red flags. Well, three times. That is absolutely crazy.
It's crazy. And the attacks, they continue. There have been multiple attacks on all three business pages, and the most recent one was yesterday afternoon.
Wow. So, yeah, maybe that is pretty unreal. If the deal does end up falling through with Microsoft, are we kind of back to square one where we're looking at another ban of the app?
Yeah, probably we are. Now, if the deal does fall through, the unfortunate thing in the immediate is you're going to have some Americans that do lose their jobs. I don't recall the specific number of Americans that are employed by TikTok in the U.S. I think it's maybe a couple thousand or so. But don't quote me on that particular number. In the short term, people will lose some jobs. TikTok will be gone. And ultimately, people are going to find another way to spend their time. But if you look to Uber as an app, right? Uber was in Austin, Texas for quite some time. The city of Austin basically kicked Uber out. And from that came a new, very similar app called Ride Austin. So let's just say TikTok gets kicked out. In the immediate, there's going to be some downtime and some difficulty. But in the long term, something new and something very cool will come right back.
Yeah, we're already seeing, I think, Instagram trying to launch their own kind of competitor to TikTok. So you're right, something will probably come up. What do you make of Instagram launching their own kind of competitor to TikTok?
No surprise, right? I mean, Instagram's owned by Facebook. Facebook's really a very aggressive company when it comes to their growth strategy. They and this was actually a big topic back in the antitrust hearings, but they are known to acquire their competitors. They're known to acquire companies that might augment their existing operations. And they really kind of, I guess they called it a M&A land grab. So like a mergers and acquisitions land grab, almost like real estate, right? So don't be surprised to see companies like Facebook constantly try and basically replicate what's out there that's being used with success. Because ultimately, they're going to try and compete just as aggressively as they can, leveraging the capital and really all the brain power they have in those offices.
And a final question here for you, Adam, and that is, how does TikTok necessarily get its value where it could be worth up to $30 billion? Is it just from the data that they store? Or I think you were alluding this earlier, they are running ads for businesses. Just talk about how they actually get that value where it can be worth that much money in such a short amount of time.
That's a lot of fun coupons, right?
Yeah, exactly.
It's a lot of fun coupons. You know, there's a few layers to the value here. The first layer, of course, is the user data. This data is so specific that basically TikTok can say, hey, listen, we have this customer profile. We know XYZ about this customer profile. Hey, Mr. Marketer, this is how you should market to these people, and they'll probably buy from you. So they're basically able to kind of pair up advertisers and publishers and direct them at the exact target market that's going to most likely buy from them. So from an advertising perspective, there's a huge ad revenue opportunity there. And frankly, Google's already doing this. Facebook's already doing it as well. But TikTok just launched their business ad manager in June. So this thing is fresh, right? And that's immediate revenue for whoever the buyer is. We'll just say Microsoft. The next layer of value, there's obviously a great ability to stream content through TikTok. Microsoft as a business has been wanting a better content syndication platform, something that would actually allow them to compete with, you know, Google's YouTube and, of course, Facebook as well. So when you look at kind of the competitive, the competitive environment of the big tech firms, this really kind of brings Microsoft to light as a much stronger player, specifically in social and in the consumer spending world. The next thing, of course, is leveraging that user data to connect with the Gen Z to build out the future of really cool software and really cool hardware, really buying what people want and doing so with the information that says this investment and this project is the least risky way to go to be successful. So there's a ton of value.
Hey, Adam, actually, one more question before we wrap things up. So if Microsoft does buy TikTok, they're certainly going to face a whole lot of headaches that other social media platforms have been facing. Of course, Microsoft was infamous from a couple of decades ago facing antitrust actions. And are you kind of thinking the same thing could happen yet again if this buyout does go through?
Looking into my marketer's crystal ball, you know, just kind of looked at 10 years from now, maybe a decade from now, and ultimately just kind of recognizing what the acquisition of TikTok could do for Microsoft from a competition perspective. Yeah, absolutely. They could find themselves basically in another antitrust hearing because the way that TikTok could help them compete against Google and Facebook could actually become something that actually is unfair based on the amount of user data that is held by TikTok. Like I said, 800 million users in TikTok now, and it's still growing, plus all these different layers of value. If Microsoft, noting the brain power that they have, I mean, Satya Nadella is a really, really smart CEO. I'm sure he could use that user data to grow the company in such a way that does make them kind of another beast of the future. So, you know, buckle up. I think we'll probably see the House Judiciary Committee having very similar conversations, assuming things don't change fast enough with the existing Congress, as it pertains to their current conversations around antitrust reform. It's going to be a really, really interesting decade ahead. It's going to be really cool to watch.
Well, we'll have to see what happens in the coming weeks and months with this potential buyout of the U.S. operations of TikTok by Microsoft. We've been speaking with Adam Ruzzieri. He is the Chief Marketing Officer for Agency Partner Interactive. Adam, really appreciate the time today. Good stuff.
My pleasure, sir. Thank you so much.
All right, and I am just about out of time for today. A reminder, coming up on Monday, the start of our new broadcast schedule. The Morning Drive with Santita Jackson going to be airing starting on Monday and every weekday from 6 until 8 a.m. And don't forget, you'll now be able to catch Ellie 2.0 Radio on Mondays from 2 until 3 p.m. You can find that full schedule over at am950radio.com with all of the changes that we've made.